All right, well, welcome everyone. And for those of you who are new tonight, so the last couple of weeks we've been reading martyrdom accounts. And we read the martyrdom account of St. Polycarp of Smyrna for the last few weeks. And in that account, we heard a lot about how St. Polycarp, just like St. Ignatius, whom we had also read earlier, both St. Ignatius and St. Polycarp very much thought of martyrdom as a share in the Eucharist, in a sense. Just as Christ said to the apostles, can you share the cup which I'm going to partake of? You know, that means the cup of martyrdom. And so for these early Christians, they very much thought of martyrdom and the Eucharist as one thing. So this is something very important that we saw in the early accounts. And of course, it's something that we nowadays, we don't really think of when we take the body and blood of Christ in church. You know, we don't really think of it as a share in martyrdom, as a share in Christ's own death and as a promise for our own life of martyrdom. But that's precisely what it is. You know, it's the body and blood of Christ, of the remission of sins and life everlasting. But it's also a commitment to live a life of martyrdom. And, you know, whether or not we are actually martyred, our heads are chopped off, or we're burned alive, or whatever creative ways that they used to kill the martyrs in the early period, all of us are still called to live a life of witness, and of course that's what martyrdom means, is witness. And so that is the theme very much for us, just as much as it is for the martyrs themselves. So this letter is an interesting letter. So it's called the Epistle of Mathetes to Diognetus. We do not really know who the author is, and we don't know who the recipient is. But there are some people who believe that actually St. Polycarp wrote this letter. And Mathetes might not actually be a name, because it also just means a student. And so in Greek, they don't have, They don't have the word like we say. Yeah.
Indefinite articles.
Indefinite article, thank you. That's the technical thing. They don't have indefinite articles in Greek. And so there's no way to tell if it's saying a student or if it's a guy whose actual name is student, because they named people names like that too. Like our patron, St. Matthew, it's something similar happening there. This is also the word for a disciple, mathetes. So it could be, we say mathetes as if it's somebody's name, but it could also mean the letter, the epistle of a disciple. And we know that in the early period, St. Ignatius himself said, when we read St. Ignatius a month or two ago, he said, I'm just now beginning to be a disciple. And so even the bishops would refer to themselves as, oh, I'm just a student. I'm just a student of Christ. Because that word disciple, it just means student. It's the same word. And in Greek, mathetes. So this epistle, generally it's thought to come from the 2nd century. That's why there are some people who think it's by St. Polycarp, also because of some similarities in language. But what this epistle is well known for is talking about Christians and what they are. And so when we read these martyrdom accounts, and we know that the pagans were very ferocious, and also the pagans and also the Jews were very much into persecuting Christians in the early period. Of course, the Jews saw the Christians as crazy heretics who were ruining their religion. And the pagans, they thought a lot of made up things about the Christians, like Christians were cannibals, Christians sacrificed children, all kinds of crazy things. Because if you're holding secret religious meetings, people will assume the worst, basically. And so they did. And so this is a very different thing. This is actually a friendly letter to a pagan, to somebody who is not Christian. It's coming from a Christian to somebody who's not a Christian, and it's written in a kind of, like I said, kind of a friendly way, explaining what Christianity is. And so while this letter is, we don't even know who wrote it, it's actually very important. It's very unique. It's very unique because we don't really have many documents like this. Nowadays, there's all kinds of Christian apologies, and you could go to a bookstore, a Christian bookstore, go on Amazon and find 500 books on apologetics of why do Christians believe what they believe, you know. Back then, there was basically nothing. You know, Christians very much, you know, just preached publicly. But this is an example of a letter to a pagan explaining what Christianity is. So that's why I thought it would be good to read. So let's go ahead and start reading here. Let's see. Matt, could you go ahead and read chapter 1 for us?
Since I see thee most excellent Diognetus, exceedingly desirous to learn the mode of worshiping God prevalent among the Christians, and inquiring very carefully and earnestly concerning them, what God they trust in, and what form of religion they observe, so as all to look down upon the world itself and despise death, while they neither esteem those to be gods that are reckoned such by the Greeks, nor hold to the superstition of the Jews, and what is the affection which they cherish among themselves, and why, in fine, this new kind of practice of piety has only now entered into the world and not long ago. I cordially welcome this thy desire, and I implore God, who enables us both to speak and to hear, to grant to me so to speak, that above all, I may hear you have been edified, and to you so to hear, that I who speak may have no cause of regret for having done so.
So that is one very long sentence. so let's. this is how people used to write. It's funny because sometimes we think that ancient people weren't very smart, that we're way smarter than ancient people, but clearly they were pretty smart because they could read and write these sentences that are very long and understand it, evidently. So he says, he greets him and he says, okay, you, Diognetus, you are exceedingly desirous to learn the mode of worshiping God prevalent among the Christians, and inquiring very carefully and earnestly concerning them. So we see here, you know, it's interesting that they're not talking about, oh, what do Christians believe? What's their faith? But he says, you want to learn how they worship God, the mode of worshiping God. That they do. And it's interesting because that's exactly how we describe ourselves as Orthodox Christians. The word Orthodox means right worship. It doesn't mean right faith necessarily, but it means, more properly, it means right worship. Nowadays, because of, especially now after the Protestant Reformation, people always think of Christianity as a faith. But it's interesting here, it's being presented as a mode of worship. Because, of course, Christianity is not just, oh, this is a set of principles I believe in, and it's abstract and separated from the rest of my life. But Christianity is something that we do. It's a mode of worship. And actually, that's very much in line with how ancient people thought. Because, you know, the pagans thought the same way. They didn't think, here's my set of beliefs, and this is, you know, I believe in Zeus, and I believe in Poseidon, and I believe, they didn't have like a creed like that listing the gods they believed in, but it was primarily how they lived their lives, and their entire life was about their mode of worship. And that's what we would say as well. And we see with modern Christians, with certain Protestant groups, of course, once you separate your faith from your worship, then your worship doesn't even really matter anymore. You can have a rock band, you can have nothing, you don't even really have to go to services because they don't really mean anything. It's all just about your personal faith. And that's, of course, not what we would say. Okay, so then he goes on. So, number one, here inquiring, number one, what God they trust in, And what, number two, what form of religion they observe. And this guy's wondering about Christians because he says, why do they look down upon the world itself and despise death? So it seems that Diognetus knows that Christians despise death. They don't really mind being martyred for whatever reason. That does seem to be one thing that people did know about Christians, is that they were martyred a lot. Of course, because that was public. While they neither esteem those to be gods that are reckoned such by the Greeks, nor hold to the superstition of the Jews. So he's saying, you know, what god do they trust in? What form of religion do they observe? And it's not what the Greeks do with their gods, and that'd be the same as the Romans. The Roman gods are the same. And a lot of the other ancient civilizations, they had different versions of the same gods. If you look at the Persian gods or the ancient Slavic pagan gods or the Norse pagan gods, and you look at the Roman and the Greek gods, they're all kind of similar. They all have at the head, they all have a god of lightning. They have a god of water and all these things. All these pagans together, Christians don't believe in those gods. Yet, they believe in the one God, yet they do not hold to the superstition of the Jews. And when we see that word superstition, nowadays superstition has a very negative connotation. Superstition is, like people knocking on wood and crossing their fingers and stuff like that. Here, and more technically, it means just the rituals they do, the rituals of the Jews. And we can imagine how confusing this would be to Greeks and Jews alike. That Christians are saying, we believe in the God of the Jews. Also, we don't do any of those things, basically, that the Jews do. You know, we're not sacrificing lambs. We're not wearing certain clothes. You know, we're not doing all the stuff that the Jews do. So you can imagine how confusing it would be. It's interesting, here that he makes this point that Christians they're not Greeks and they're not Jews. And this is actually exactly what St. Paul says. He says, there's neither Jew nor Greek. He says they're neither Jew nor Greek in Galatians. And so, Christians are in this weird place where they're not Jews or Greeks, but they're a new people. And this is actually what he says right here. So if we go on, he says, what is the affection which they cherish among themselves? So why do Christians have this love for one another? And why, this would be kind of the fourth point, in fine, this new kind or practice has only now entered into the world and not long ago. So this is a bit of archaic English here. He says, from this translator, this new kind, that means kind, like mankind, a kind of people. So this would be better translated like people or race or ethnicity. The word here in Greek is, I looked it up, and it's genos, G-E-N-O-S, which is where we get our word for genes, genetics. And so this would also, so probably the best way to translate that into more modern English would be race, actually. I think it's very good to recognize that the early Christians, nowadays people talk a lot about racism and things like that, of course, but it's good to recognize that the early Christians were very clear that Christians are a race. Christians are a people, a defined people. That word genos, it's where genes and genetics come from, but it's also where, birth comes from, Genesis. And that word, beginning. That word Genesis is very closely related to the word birth, actually. We just had the Feast of the Dormition, and in English we say, in giving birth, you preserved your virginity. And in Greek, it is antigenesi. In Genesis, you preserved your virginity. So again, this idea of a race is that we're all born. And of course, we're all born, we all receive a new birth when we're baptized. And so we're all children of the church. We're all children of God. You know, and so this is why we are a race. And I think that's very important to recognize. And I'm actually going to take an aside here for a second, because you can actually see here, if you look at the prophecy of Isaiah, which is this section of Isaiah in the chapters 40s and 50s is one of the most important sections of the Old Testament. This is where we get all the imagery of Christ's crucifixion, all the prophetic words about how Christ would suffer. This almost all of it comes from this section of Isaiah. And so together in this section, it says, "I have given you unto a covenant of the race, a light to the nations." So we see here in Greek, it says, "Ke evoka, I have given see to you." Is viathikin genus. So that's the same word, genus, where this word comes from of race. You know, Christians as a race or a kind, as this translator has. And then it says a light to the nations. So the nations are called ethnon. And so this is where our word ethnicity comes from. And so it's interesting that there's a distinction here that the prophet Isaiah speaks about, okay, there's going to be a covenant. There's a covenant of the race, which is a light to the nations. And so you can see it's not the same word that's being used. And so, you know, we believe that we're the continuation of the people Israel, God's new people, but we're also a continuation of the same people. So it's important to recognize that, you know, Christians as that word, genos or genus, we are that, you know. And so I think that's nice to remember. You know, we can, you know, I was just kind of looking at this just to see. And so the epistle to Diognetus calls Christians a new race. The author has kind, but the word is race. Genos, the word is genos. In the Septuagint, the Greek language Old Testament, the former Israel is sometimes called an ethnos. And so he says, God says to Abraham, "I will make you a great ethnon, a great ethnicity, and in you all the phile," which means tribes, "of the earth will be blessed." So the original promise to Abraham was not exactly a genos, but it was to be a nation among the nations. But then this idea came out later among the prophets that, you know, okay, God's people is really more of a race. And then, of course, this we realized then that the prophets were speaking about the Christians that were coming. So this new kind, this new genos, new race, or practice. Again, Christians are defined by what they do. At this point in time, they're not thinking about it as what's the faith, but what is the practice. So why has it only now entered into the world and not long ago? So the author, if it is St. Polycarp or if it's somebody else, he's going to explain why it is that Christians only are entering the world right now. And of course, he's going to speak about Christ and that. But, you know, that is an important thing to think about. You know, okay, why all of a sudden are there people who believe in the Jewish God but don't do Jewish practices? And he's going to explain that. So then he says, "I cordially welcome this desire and I implore God, who enables us both to speak and to hear, to grant me to so speak, that above all I may hear you have been edified, and to you so hear that I speak, and I have no cause of regret for having done so." Okay. All right, Sarah, could you read chapter 2?
Does it all fit?
I'll scroll for me.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. "Come then, after you have freed yourself from all prejudices possessing your mind, and laid aside what you have been accustomed to as something apt to deceive you, and being made as if from the beginning a new man, inasmuch as, according to your own confession, you are to be the hearer of a new system of doctrine. Come and contemplate, not with your eyes only, but with your understanding, the substance and the form of those whom ye declare and deem to be gods. Is not one of them a stone similar to that on which we tread? Is not a second brass in no way superior to those vessels which are constructed for our ordinary use? Is not a third wood, and that already rotten? Is not a fourth silver, which needs a man to watch it, lest it be stolen? Is not a fifth iron, consumed by rust? Is not a sixth earthenware, in no degree more valuable than that which is formed for the humblest purposes? Are not all these of corruptible matter? Are they not fabricated by means of iron and fire? Did not the sculptor fashion one of them, the brazier a second, the silversmith a third, and the potter a fourth? Was not every one of them, before they were formed by the arts of these workmen into the shape of these gods, each in its own way subject to change? Would not those things which are now vessels, formed of the same materials, become like to such if they met with the same artificers? Might not these, which are now worshipped by you, again be made by men vessels similar to others? Are they not all deaf? Are they not all blind? Are they not all without life? Are they not destitute of feeling? Are they not incapable of motion? Are they not all liable to rot? Are they not all corruptible? These things ye call gods, these ye serve, these ye worship, and ye become altogether like to them. For this reason ye hate the Christians, because they do not deem these to be gods. But do not ye yourselves, who now think and suppose such to be gods, much more cast contempt upon them than they, the Christians, do? Do ye not much more mock and insult them when ye worship those that are made of stone and earthenware, without appointing any persons to guard them? But those made of silver and gold ye shut up by night, and appoint watchers to look after them by day, lest they be stolen. And by those gifts which ye mean to present to them, do ye not, if they are possessed of sense, rather punish than honor them? But if, on the other hand, they are destitute of sense, ye convict them of this fact, while ye worship them with blood and the smoke of sacrifices. Let any one of you suffer such indignities. Let any one of you endure to have such things done to himself. But not a single human being will, unless compelled to it, endure such treatment, since he is endowed with sense and reason. A stone, however, readily bears it, seeing it is insensible. Certainly you do not show by your conduct that he, your God, is possessed of sense. And as to the fact that Christians are not accustomed to serve such gods, I might easily find many other things to say. But if even what has been said does not seem to anyone sufficient, I deem it idle to say anything further.
All right, so a long section there, but I think we got the point. So he's basically saying, you know, free yourself from your prejudices. You know, we might say, nowadays we might say preconceptions, preconceived notions, you know. And lay aside what you have been accustomed to. You know, and become a new man. And of course, this is language straight from St. Paul. Become a new man. You are to be a hearer of a new system of doctrine. And he says, so the first thing he attacks, of course, are these idols. And the author uses some imagery here that is taken from the Old Testament. There's a lot of the Old Testament. They also say these same things about the idols. And, you know, the gods of the nations are demons, the idols are demons, these kinds of things. He doesn't even really go to that here. But they do talk about what the idols are made out of. Of course, the Jews had a very strong sense that their God was not material, even though he might dwell in the temple, he might dwell in the Ark of the Covenant, in a sense, but he was not material. And these kind of lowly materials, and of course, was definitely not made out of these materials. So he says, okay, they're stone, they're brass, they're wood, they're silver. And he talks, and he even, each one of these things, he kind of says something negative about. Okay, wood can rot, silver is going to be stolen, iron is going to be rusted. And of course, he makes the point here. Did not the sculptor fashion one of them? The brazier a second, the silversmith a third. So, if, I mean, obvious, I mean, these arguments are obvious to us. But, you know, it's good to think about what he's doing, I think, which is that, as he said in the beginning, free yourself from these prejudices. And if we're thinking about, you know, how could we approach somebody nowadays and try to present orthodoxy to them, try to present the Orthodox Christian faith and worship to them, you know, we might have to say kind of the same thing, like, free yourself from what you know. You know, maybe somebody's coming from an evangelical background and they'll be really turned off by the smells and bells and everything. Or maybe somebody's coming from a different background and, you know, whatever. And so that's always important to think about. You know, if we're going to bring somebody to church or talk about our faith, we have to kind of recognize where they're coming from, too. But then he does, even though I said this kind of a friendly letter, he does really attack the idols here. But as I've said before here, I think it was very common in the Roman Empire that people really didn't believe in the idols that much anyway. They didn't really think too much about what they were doing. They just kind of did it because, oh, this is what everybody does. Everybody sacrifices to idols. We'll just do it too, without any thought about it, really. So, you know, he says, are they not all deaf? Are they not blind? That's from the prophets make these same accusations about the idols. The idols are deaf, the idols are blind. And so even though he's not quoting scripture here, he is very much using the scriptural language. You know, they're deaf, idols are blind, they're deaf, they have no life, they can't move. You know, and this is, again, it's from the prophets. It's interesting here that he doesn't, basically in this entire letter, he does not quote from scripture directly at all, but he comes very close to it in certain places. You know, the idea of quoting scripture at somebody as a way of trying to convert them, of course, is not something we really do as Orthodox Christians. You know, we're not, and obviously it wouldn't mean anything to the recipient to do that. So he says, these things ye call gods, these ye serve, these ye worship, and ye become altogether like to them. They become deaf, they become blind. They become without life because they're just following these idols. For this reason, ye hate the Christians because they do not deem these to be gods. Right? So he's saying, you guys hate Christians because we're not worshiping these rocks and silver and wood just like you guys are. But he's saying, then he goes on to say, you actually cast more contempt upon them than Christians do. Because Christians don't offer to the idols. But he's saying, look, when you offer to the idols... First he says, the ones that are made out of stone, you don't guard, but the ones that are made out of silver and gold, you shut them up because they're going to get stolen. So clearly you don't even believe in these gods, because if the gods had any power, you wouldn't have to lock them up so they wouldn't get stolen. And then he goes on, yeah, then he goes on to say, by those gifts which you mean to present to them, do you not punish them? You worship them with blood and the smoke of sacrifices. So you remember when these people would sacrifice to idols, you know, they would, you know, throw blood right on the idol. You know, they would chop off a ram's neck or something like that and pour the blood out right on the idol. And so he's saying, wouldn't this be, if they actually were alive, this would actually be a very rude thing to do. You know, this would be a very strange thing to do. So he's saying, basically, you don't even really believe this. Because you wouldn't do that to a person, he says. Not a single person would endure such treatment, you know, having blood poured on them all day long. And so he says, you know, in summary, of course Christians do not serve such gods, but he doesn't really need to say much else. So he presents his argument here is very well planned out. He says, first he talks about why Christians are not like pagans, and now he explains why Christians do not follow the Jewish rituals. Catherine, would you like to read that?
And next, I imagine that you are most desirous of hearing something on this point, that the Christians do not observe the same forms of divine worship as do the Jews. The Jews, then, if they abstain from the kind of service, above described, and deem it proper to worship one God as being Lord of all, are right. But if they offer him worship in the way in which we have described, they greatly err. For while Gentiles offer, by offering such things to those that are destitute of sense and hearing, furnish an example of madness, they, on the other hand, by thinking to offer these things to God as if he needed them, might justly reckon it rather an act of folly than of divine worship. For he that made the heavens and the earth and all that there is that is therein, and gives to us all the things which we stand in need, certainly requires none of those things which he himself bestowed on such as think of furnishing them to him. But those who imagine that by means of blood and the smoke of sacrifices and burnt offerings, they offer sacrifices acceptable to him, and that by such honors they show him respect, these, by supposing that they can give anything to him who stands in need of nothing, appear to me in no respect to differ from those who studiously confer the same honor on things destitute of sense, and which therefore are unable to enjoy such honors.
So I think the key line here, sorry about that, I forgot to scroll down. The key line here is the Jews suppose that they can give anything to God who in fact stands in need of nothing. And so the author is basically saying that, you know, if a Jew thinks that God needs a lamb or a cow or doves or whatever sacrifice to him, you know, the Jew, he's just as wrong as the pagan is, because of course God doesn't need any of these things. You know, and I think us too, you know, sometimes we could err into that side of thinking. Yes.
Okay, so this paragraph I found a little difficult to swallow personally. And I'll explain this, and it might be that I'm completely off the deep end. But I was under the impression that the reason the sacrifices appointed by God for the Jews are not part of Christianity is because Christ has fulfilled that role. You don't have to sacrifice a lamb because the lamb has been sacrificed.
Right.
Yeah. That was kind of my understanding. And so the Jews who continue in their practice obviously don't accept that Christ did that.
Right.
You know, am I completely looping on that, or
no? I think
I don't know if people followed what I was saying.
I think so. Are you? Because I think I kind of felt the same way. It's, you know, they're doing it because God did tell them to do that.
Right.
You know, we would still be doing that too if Christ had not. I mean, I don't know. You know what I mean, though. If Christ hadn't come, the Jews would have kept on doing this under the command of God, and. It was kind of my understanding that not, you know, they didn't sacrifice because he needed those things, but because as showing that God is more important to them than their stuff.
It was an obedience.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think he's not criticizing their offering the things, but he's criticizing how they think about it.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's saying they think to offer these things to God as if he needed them. So I think what he's getting at is not that the act itself is wrong, but if you think of it as God needs me to do this, then that doesn't make sense.
More like how the pagans would sacrifice to their gods in order to get their God to do something for them, kind of that way. Like, if I do this for God, then God's going to do this for me.
And many of us think that way nowadays, right?
Yeah.
I do agree, though, this is not maybe as convincing as what you said, Paul, which is that Christ, you know, fulfilled these things for us. These things were put in place until Christ. He doesn't make that argument here. I'm guessing part of the reason he doesn't make that argument, too, is just because he hasn't even gotten to Christ yet.
He's talking to someone who's neither Jew nor Christian.
Yeah.
So that they wouldn't have a frame of reference, perhaps.
So I think what he's going for is that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's more to say just the idea of these kind of ritual sacrifices in general doesn't make sense.
Now, I don't know very much about sacrifices in Greek and Roman practice, but they were certainly very widely practiced.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm not certain what the intent was in those cases.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I know that in the ancient world that it's almost like any time you would eat, in a sense, especially meat, it would be like a sacrifice. You know, it would be, if you were going to, like, eat your, lamb that you raised or whatever, you would go sacrifice it and then eat it. And there was a certain... They say that the temples in ancient pagan Greece and pagan Rome, the temples were actually the first restaurants. Because that's where you could go and kind of to a public place and get food outside of your home. So it was very much a very, just much part of life. I think what he's getting to, he's trying to appeal to this person in a logical way as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we could do and what we're going to see in the next paragraph is he goes and attacks more of these practices of the Jews. And I think, these are some of the same things that Christ himself accused of the Pharisees of doing. But this author goes further. So we'll see. Yeah. All right. Melissa, would you like to read chapter 4?
But as to their scrupulosity concerning meats and their superstition as respects the Sabbaths and their boasting about circumcision, and their fancies about fasting, and the new moons, which are utterly ridiculous and unworthy of notice, I do not think that you require to learn anything from me. For to accept some of those things which have been formed by God for the use of men as properly formed, and to reject others as useless and redundant, how can this be lawful? And to speak falsely of God, as if he forbade us to do what is good on the Sabbath days, how is this not impious? And to glory in the circumcision of the flesh as a proof of election, and as if, on account of it, they were specially beloved by God, how is it not a subject of ridicule? And as to their observing months and days, as if waiting upon the stars and the moon, and their distributing, according to their own tendencies, the appointments of God, and the vicissitudes of the seasons, some for festivities and others for mourning, who would deem this as part of divine worship, and not much rather a manifestation of folly? I suppose then that you are sufficiently convinced that the Christians properly abstain from the vanity and error common to both Jews and Gentiles, and from the busybody spirit and vain boasting of the Jews. But you must not hope to learn the mystery of their peculiar mode of worshiping God from any mortal.
So again, he's explaining why Christians aren't following these Jewish practices, and he's using this kind of logical argument of like, of course these things don't logically make sense, and I think this is kind of the tension as we talked about, as Sarah and Paul were saying, like, God did command the Jews to do these things, but also through the coming of Christ, we realize, like, okay, those things don't really totally make sense. And you know, Christ fulfilled all these things. And he did all these things. You know, he was circumcised. He did follow the law and things like that. But, you know, at the same time, I mean, logically, these things don't totally make sense. And, you know, we have to think, when we think about our own practices, you know, we do things that make sense. I mean, we, you know, like, you know, how we fast, right? I mean, we fast from meat is the main thing we fast from, and also from dairy, and sometimes also from wine and olive oil and these things. And, you know, we fast from meat because it tastes good, but it's also to, it's very practical, you know, in that it's a way of, you know, humbling ourselves, and it's a way of cutting off our desires and cutting off our will, and, you know, so the church has kind of set up the fasts this way, right? But when the Jews would fast, of course, they would think, oh, God told us not to eat pork because, you know, pork is bad or something. And, you know, there are different theories about why that might be. But, you know, we don't believe that, oh, the reason we don't eat meat during Lent is because meat is bad or something like that. You know, so what we do as Christians nowadays, we try to do things that make sense. And of course, we could say these are some of the same things that Christ said to the Jews himself, right? Christ came and said, you know, you forbid people to do what is good on the Sabbath, you know. You know, because there's some things in the law where it says, you know, if your donkey is stuck, ox in the ditch, that kind of thing, yeah. If your ox is in the ditch, you know, you're allowed to get it out on the Sabbath, but then, oh, but if a person is in a ditch, you can't get them out, or something like that, you know, because that's not specifically there. And of course, Christ himself says the point of the law are the two great commandments, right? You shall love the Lord your God, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. You know, so St. Paul also says, you know, it is through the law that I died to the law, is what St. Paul says. So, you know, it's a hard thing to totally always grasp, you know, why we stop doing all these practices. And of course, many of it is because Christ fulfilled them. But then there are certain things then we do keep, like, you know, using incense, having churches instead of a temple and things like that. And, you know, some other Christians would say that we're wrong for doing that. We do have feast days. If you noticed here, he talks about, you know, you set aside some seasons for festivities and some for mourning. Who would deem this a part of divine worship? And of course, we do that. We do that. You know, we have Lent, and we have seasons of festivities and seasons of mourning. But I think the Jews, I think they understood it differently, and I think that's the issue, you know. You know, because even when we're mourning, even if we think about the day liturgically where we mourn the most on Holy Friday, we still talk about the resurrection in the hymns of Holy Friday, you know. So there's never absolute mourning. And on the resurrection, on the Feast of Pascha, on the resurrection, we still talk about the cross, you know. So it's not, we always kind of balance it, but, you know. You know, and so that's, I think, what we present as Christians is it's, you know, it's through the cross joy comes into the world. And so, I don't know. We have seasons, but it's maybe not exactly thought of as the same. Yeah.
Maybe it's like when Jesus said, like, when you fast, do not be like the hypocrites. And so maybe the Jews were being showy and hypocritical in their fasting. Mm-hmm. And then when they were feasting, they would go into excess, like gluttony. And
yeah. I think that's probably right. Yeah, I mean, I think that sounds good, because again, what he's saying, it's he's making the same accusations that Christ made very much.
Didn't he also criticize Christ for healing on the Sabbath?
Yeah.
At the expense of the person who was being healed?
Right.
It was kind of like, go by the rule, but don't harm somebody because you're your rule.
Right. They would, and they thought that the rules were more important than the spirit of the rules. Yeah. Definitely. You know, and so they thought of it as, well, God gave us these rules, and you know, and some, but a lot of the rules that they were doing were also additions, you know, on top of what's actually in the law. So we have to remember that too. You know, a lot of things that Jews today do now is not directly from the law. And they don't, a lot of them don't do the things that are in the law anymore. They don't do the animal sacrifices and things like that. But that was already starting in Christ's time, especially the Pharisees who then became the rabbis. Okay, so let's see how far we go here. So, well, we're over 45 minutes, so I think we could stop there. And then next time we will get to the what I think is the most interesting part here, are these chapters of 5 and 6 talking about who Christians are. And then later he gets into Christ and explains all that as well. All right.